Welcome back to another Ghosts of the Pacific edition of Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 121, Stories from Punch Bowl, Part 1. I must admit, dear listener, that Ernie Pyle's story took a lot out of me. It took a lot longer than I thought it would, which is par for the course with most people I talk about on this podcast. With that said, I have what will likely be one more long story arc centered around the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific before I return to the original focus of this podcast, Arlington. But before I get to that, I am going to spend the next two episodes sharing several short vignettes about notable individuals from diverse backgrounds who were ultimately buried at Punch Bowl. Way back in episode 80, I told the story of Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Ellison Onizuka, the first astronaut from Hawaii who was killed when the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded shortly after liftoff in 1986. But L is not the only astronaut interred at Punch Bowl, so before I go any further, let's cue the space music. This one's for you, JB.
Yes, sir. Reading you loud and clear. Clear. The clock has started.
Five, 5, 4, 4, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1, 1.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Charles Lacey Veach, known as Lacey most of his life, was born in Chicago, Illinois on September 18, 1944, but considered Honolulu, Hawaii to be his hometown. His parents relocated there when he was young. From a young age, Veach knew exactly what he wanted to do when he grew up. At age 6, he brought a comic book to his mother and said to her, "You see this guy in the comic book? That's what I'm going to be." It was a picture of a man standing on what looked like the moon with a fishbowl on his head. This was more than a decade before the Soviets put Yuri Gagarin in space. But he was right. He became the second astronaut from Hawaii. Veach graduated from Punahou Prep School in Honolulu in 1962, and received a degree in engineering management from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1966. After the academy, he went to Moody Air Force Base, Georgia, where he earned his pilot wings in 1967, and then he attended fighter gunnery school at Luke Air Force Base, Arizona. Over the next 14 years, he served as a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot, flying the F-100 Super Sabre, the F-111 Aardvark, and the F-105 Thunder Chief on assignments in the United States, Europe, and the Far East, including 275 combat missions in South Vietnam. In 1976 and 1977, he flew as a member of the Air Force Demonstration Squadron, the Thunderbirds, flying the T-38 Talon. Veach left active duty in 1981, but continued to fly the F-4 Phantom and the F-16 Fighting Falcon with the Texas Air National Guard. His name still adorns the static display F-16 just inside the front gate of the Ellington Field Joint Reserve Base in Houston, Texas. By the time his pilot career came to an end, he had logged more than 5,000 flight hours. Veach came to work for NASA in 1982 as an engineer and research test pilot at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. His primary duty was as an instructor pilot in the shuttle training aircraft, a highly modified Gulfstream II used to train astronaut pilots to land the space shuttle. He was selected as an astronaut candidate in 1984 and became an astronaut in June 1985. Despite his experience flying, he didn't become an astronaut pilot himself, but instead was a mission specialist. In 1991, he flew on Space Shuttle Discovery as part of the STS-39 mission, and again in 1992 on Space Shuttle Columbia as part of the STS-52 mission. He spent a total of 18 days, 4 hours, and 18 minutes in space. On his first shuttle flight, a fellow crew member woke Veach and told him to look out the window. They were passing over the Hawaiian Islands. He felt that he could see all the islands, and he could see his whole spirit and soul. He saw the entire planet in one vision. Shortly before his death, he said, "You can never believe the beauty of Island Earth until you see it in its entirety from space." A friend once described him as the world's greatest optimist. After his two shuttle flights, he longed to return to Hawaii, but health issues prevented that. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lacey Veach died of cancer on October 3, 1995. He was 51 years old. His ashes were placed in Punchbowl's Columbarium, Court 3, Wall J, Niche 233. He was the recipient of 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 14 Air Medals, 2 Air Force Commendation Medals, and the Purple Heart. Toshiyuki Sakata was born on July 1, 1920, in Hualoa, Hawaii, on the Big Island, to an Issei father, a first-generation immigrant who had been born in Japan, and a Nisei mother, an American born to first-generation Japanese-born immigrant parents. He had 10 siblings, 6 brothers and 4 sisters. He adopted the Western name Harold when he was a teenager. In 1936, Sakata dropped out of high school to help work the family's coffee farm. The following year, he started working at a sugar plantation, 75 miles or 120 kilometers from home, before moving to the island of Lanai to work on a pineapple plantation, and then to Maui for more agricultural work. In 1938, he ended up in Honolulu on the island of Oahu, where he would live for much of his adult life. Sakata was a slight child. When he turned 18, he was 5 feet 8 inches or 173 centimeters tall and weighed just 113 pounds or 51 kilograms. In his own words, he wanted to look as good as the other guys, so he started lifting weights. Because all YMCAs were segregated at the time, he trained primarily at the All-Asian Nuuanu YMCA, where one of his training partners was future Amateur Athletic Union champion Imric Ishikawa. After a year of serious training, Sakata had put on 20 pounds, more than 9 kilograms, of muscle. Inspired by these results, he started entering local weightlifting competitions and in 1941 won the Territorial Light Heavyweight Championship. Following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Sakata joined the Army and served with the 1399th Engineer Construction Battalion, that remained on Oahu for most of the war. This allowed him plenty of time to continue to train, and over the next 2 years, he won several more competitions. After the war, he was discharged from the army and became the de facto leader of a group of local lifters in Honolulu. During a tournament in 1946, Sakata set a Hawaiian record in both the snatch and the clean and jerk, plus an unofficial world record in the press. He also won the Mr. Hawaii physique title that same year. During his successful 1946 competition season, Sakata caught the eye of one of Hawaii's competition directors, who suggested that he organize a team to compete in the 1947 USA Weightlifting National Championships in Dallas, Texas. Sakata did just that and took first in the 181-pound or 82-kilogram weight class. Another member of Sakata's team, Richard Tom, placed first in the 123-pound or 56-kilogram division. Thanks to their first-place finishes at Nationals, both men qualified for the 1948 Summer Olympics in London. At the Olympics, Sakata won the silver medal in the light heavyweight division behind fellow American Stan Stanzik. After the London Games, Sakata retired from weightlifting and began training as a professional wrestler. At the end of World War II, he had grown to 5 feet 10 inches or 178 centimeters tall, and all of his training had helped him eventually bulk up to 284 pounds or 129 kilograms. He initially wrestled as the human tank Mr. Sakata, drawing on his World War II service and Olympic success to play a face, wrestling slang for a good guy, though he later adopted his better-known heel or bad guy gimmick known as Tosh Togo. From July 1951 through January 1952, Sakata joined a wrestling promotion that toured Japan. When that gig ended, most of the wrestlers returned to the United States, but he stayed in Tokyo for another few months, during which time he met and married his wife. The couple had two children together, one in 1954 and the other in 1957, but would eventually divorce due to the strain his constant travel put on the family. Sakata returned to the U.S. in 1952 and appeared in his first televised wrestling match that same year on May 26th. During his career, he captured 3 heavyweight championships across 3 different wrestling organizations, but found more success as part of a tag team. He won 9 tag team championships with 8 teammates across 6 different promotions. In 1964, Sakata had another career change when Harry Saltzman and Robert R. Broccoli, the producers of the James Bond movie franchise, cast him as Oddjob, the intimidating henchman of the main villain in the movie Goldfinger. It is this role that brought him the most fame of his career. Though Sakata had never acted outside of pro wrestling, the character had no spoken lines other than a few uttered grunts and would require little theatrical skill. It was his size coupled with his intimidating gaze that landed him the role. As Oddjob, he played the bodyguard of Bond nemesis Auric Goldfinger, and his sharpened, steel-brimmed bowler hat became a famous and much-parodied trademark of the Bond series. While filming Oddjob's death scene in which the character is electrocuted, oops, spoilers, that is, if you can spoil a movie that's 60 years old, Sakata's hands were badly burned by the effect, but he held on until the director called cut. After Goldfinger, he appeared in several other movies in similar roles and took on the name Oddjob as an unofficial middle name and appeared as Harold Oddjob Sakata in many film credits. With time, his acting skills increased, which led to speaking roles in film and TV projects and commercials. In 1974, he co-starred opposite William Shatner in the movie Impulse, and landed guest-starring roles on several TV shows, the best known of which are probably Gilligan's Island, The Rockford Files, The Amazing Spider-Man, and Hawaii Five-0. Army Technician 5th Class Toshiyuki Harold Sakata died of liver cancer on July 29, 1982, in Honolulu, Hawaii, 4 weeks after his 62nd birthday. 5 months before his passing, Sakata made one final public appearance at the 54th Academy Awards. He briefly appeared on stage in his odd job attire during Sheena Easton's eponymous musical number for the James Bond film For Your Eyes Only. I know that there are many people out there who put military service members on a bit of a pedestal. I know this because I have seen it. I also know, because I have seen it too, that this probably shouldn't be the case. Not in today's all-volunteer U.S. force, and especially less so when the draft is instituted and thousands upon thousands of people are called up and obligated to serve. Did you know that there is a section of the Wassenaar American Cemetery in France, known as Plot E, that is roughly 100 meters from the rest of the cemetery, hidden out of sight, and contains what the Grave Registration Department refers to as the Dishonored Dead? Plot E currently contains the remains of 94 American military prisoners, former American military service members, who were all executed under military authority for crimes committed during or shortly after World War II. Per regulations, all had been dishonorably discharged from the military the day before their execution. No U.S. flag is permitted to fly over this section of the cemetery, and the numbered graves lie with their backs turned to the main cemetery on the other side of the road. The headstones in Plot E are not labeled with names and other biographical information, but numbers only. It wasn't until a Freedom of Information Act request in 2009 that someone was able to publicly put names to the numbers. Now, granted, this is an extreme case, but there are other less than desirable sorts that have made their way into both Arlington and Punch Bowl. I plan to talk about the one person I would remove from Arlington before any antiquated monuments or memorials, and I will talk about someone in Punch Bowl who might have been better off being interred at a different cemetery. Leo Earl Sharp Sr. was an American World War II veteran, a horticulturalist, and, oh yeah, a drug courier for a branch of the Sinaloa cartel. Sharp was born in Michigan City, Indiana, on May 7, 1924, and raised in Detroit, Michigan. During World War II, he fought in the Italian campaign and received a Bronze Star for Valor during his service. At some point after the war, Sharp claimed to have been the owner of a small airline company that eventually went bankrupt. He later became a horticulturalist, who became world-renowned in botanical circles for hybridizing popular new breeds of flowers. He produced relatively small flowers with vibrant colors, the most famous of which was a daylily called Ojo Poco, a 2.5-inch or 64-millimeter apricot-colored flower with a red bullseye at the center that he introduced in 1994. Daylily enthusiasts visited Sharp's flower farm called Brookwood Gardens near his hometown of Michigan City, where he lived for decades. His neighbors recalled buses filled with customers waiting outside his front gate, waiting to buy his signature flowers. He traveled across the country on speaking tours and with conventions, and even claimed that he had once been invited to the White House, where he planted flowers in the Rose Garden for President George H.W. Bush. But while he may have been famous for his flowers, it seems that this was not the most lucrative business. Despondent from financial problems, Sharp was eventually approached by Mexican laborers at his flower farm, who helped convince him to transport narcotics for the large international Sinaloa drug cartel. His success in eluding the detection of law enforcement for more than 10 years while transporting thousands of pounds of cocaine made him a legend among drug traffickers who knew of his exploits. He used a Lincoln Mark LT pickup to transport between 220 and 660 pounds, or 100 to 300 kilos of cocaine at a time from the southern U.S. border to Detroit, Michigan. The cartel also used Sharp to transport drug proceeds in excess of $2 million per return trip from Michigan to Arizona in the same truck. In July 2011, while in possession of 440 pounds or 200 kilos of cocaine, the then 87-year-old was arrested by the Michigan State Police during a coordinated arrest operation led by the Drug Enforcement Agency. The arrest was captured by a state police dash cam and published in the New York Times. The criminal investigation was prosecuted by Assistant U.S. Attorney General Chris Graveline, culminating in the indictments of 25 members of the cartel, including Sharp. At his sentencing, Sharp made an official statement saying, "I'm really heartbroken I did what I did, but it is done." In an effort to avoid prison, Sharp offered to pay a $500,000 fine he owed the government for illegally growing Hawaiian papayas, but that offer was declined and he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. He was released in 2015 after serving only 1 year due to poor health. Sharp died of natural causes on December 12, 2016. He was 92 years old. I'm not entirely sure how he ended up at Punch Bowl since he died in Michigan and there are many cemeteries, including several national cemeteries between Michigan and Hawaii. But Army Private First Class Leo Earl Sharp Sr. is buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Section CT 13 Alpha, Row 100, Grave 150. If his story sounds familiar, the 2018 Clint Eastwood film The Mule, where Eastwood played drug mule Earl Stone, was based on Sharp. There are a few individuals at Punch Bowl who, while not well known throughout the United States or the wider world beyond, became legends in their local community. Take, for example, Sailor Jerry. Norman Keith Collins was born in Reno, Nevada on January 14, 1911, and grew up in Northern California. As a child, he hopped on freight trains and traveled all over the continental United States. He was also apparently extremely stubborn, and his parents often called him Jerry after the family mule, who was equally hard-headed. During his time riding the rails, he learned tattooing from a man known as Big Mike using the hand-poke method. That would be the method that forgoes electric tattoo equipment and applies the ink to the skin by attaching a needle to a rod-like contraption, much like a pencil and thread. Later in the 1920s, he moved to Chicago and met Tats Thomas, who taught him how to use a tattoo machine. During this time, he practiced on drunks brought in from Skid Row. After his stint in the Windy City, Collins wanted to return to a nomadic lifestyle, so in 1930, at age 19, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy and earned the sailor part of his nickname. And since he was known as Sailor Jerry professionally for the rest of his life, that is what I am going to call him for the rest of this spotlight. Sailor Jerry sailed all over during his Navy career, but spent most of his time in the Pacific and Southeast Asia. Imagery from those regions heavily influenced his tattooing going forward. It was also during this time in service that he was able to better hone his tattooing skills, which was seen as fairly taboo in U.S. society outside of the military at the time. During his time overseas, Sailor Jerry developed friendships with some of the Horis, honorary masters of tattooing in Japan, yet another culture that has a taboo history with tattoos. While tattoos are fairly mainstream in the U.S. today, they are still not part of polite society in Japan due to their connection with the Yakuza, or Japanese mafia. Jerry learned many coveted trade secrets from the Horis, which he later employed in his own style. The sophisticated and masterful technique he learned from these Japanese masters is one of the reasons Sailor Jerry tattoos are considered some of the best American traditional tattoos in history. Boasting a good sense of humor to go along with his skills, Jerry jokingly gave himself the title Horismoku, which translates to Holy Smoke, as he grew as a tattooer. After his enlistment, Sailor Jerry settled in Hawaii and took up tattooing professionally. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, he wanted to get back into the Navy but had developed some heart problems that prevented his return. The Merchant Marines, on the other hand, were more than happy to let him join their service and made him a lieutenant commander. He survived 4 ships being sunk under him throughout the war. By all accounts, he was a very capable ship navigator, so maybe the Japanese Imperial Navy took exception with him exporting some of their tattoo trade secrets to the United States. After World War II, Sailor Jerry permanently set up shop in Hawaii. During his career as a tattoo artist, he also worked as the skipper of a large 3-masted schooner on which he conducted tours of the Hawaiian Islands, which I feel is only natural for a guy known as Sailor Jerry. In addition to tattooing and sailing, he played the saxophone in his own dance band and frequently hosted his own radio show, where he was known as Old Ironsides, a reference to the oldest ship in the U.S. Navy, commissioned during the War of 1812 and still in operation today. Sailor Jerry made significant contributions to the art of tattooing. He expanded the array of colors available by developing his own pigments, specifically a purple that helped his tattoos stand out from other artists in Hawaii. He created custom needle formations that embedded pigment with much less trauma to the skin. He became one of the first artists to utilize single-use needles and had one of the first studios to use an autoclave to sterilize its equipment. Tattoo artists today can trace the solid line work, bold colors, and iconic designs they love back to Sailor Jerry. As the godfather of American traditional tattooing, his portfolio influenced and changed the old-school American traditional styles offered in shops worldwide. A mixture of the influence of the Horis blended with the lifestyle themes that Sailor Jerry picked up while tattooing military men on shore leave in Hawaii. In places like Hotel Street, soldiers, sailors, and Marines drank heavily and visited brothels frequently. They bonded over sailing experiences, patriotism, and their lust for adventure. These influences can be seen in many of Jerry's designs, which frequently included bottles of booze, birds, specifically birds of prey and swallows, dice, snakes, wildcats, motor heads and pistons, anchors and nautical stars, classically styled scroll banners, Hawaiian themes, and pinup girls. Sailor Jerry's last studio was in Honolulu's Chinatown, which at the time was the only place on the island where tattoo parlors were permitted. The site became China Sea Tattoo after his death. His influence on modern tattooing is widely recognized and partially credited with tattooing's emergence into mainstream U.S. culture. On June 9, 1972, Sailor Jerry suffered a heart attack while riding his motorcycle. He died 3 days later. Navy Seaman First Class and Merchant Marine Lieutenant Commander Norman Keith Sailor Jerry Collins is buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Section T, Grave 124. Before he died, he made his wife promise him that if his protégés Ed Hardy, Mike Malone, and Zeke Owen didn't buy his studio, she would burn it to the ground. Malone stepped in and bought it, so she didn't have to carry out his final wish. In 1999, Malone and Hardy partnered with an independent Philadelphia-based advertising agency to establish Sailor Jerry Ltd., the limited company which owns the rights to Jerry's letters, art, and tattoo flashes, uses his designs on clothing, shoes, playing cards, shot glasses, bottle openers, and other such tchotchkes. The company also showcases rising talents within the tattoo industry in its artist series, which it describes as a way to keep Sailor Jerry's legacy alive and kicking. And, because of course it does, the company also produces what it calls a spiced Navy rum featuring a quintessential Sailor Jerry hula girl on the label. None of Sailor Jerry's family profits from his creations or the things that have come of them since his death. His widow Louise has filed a legal dispute against Sailor Jerry Ltd. Since 2015, an annual independently produced event has taken place on the Hawaiian island of Oahu every June called the Sailor Jerry Festival to honor his legacy and Chinatown roots. The multi-venue event includes live music, DJs, cabaret performances, an art show, neighborhood tours, and tattoos available at three area shops, including Jerry's last studio. A portion of the proceeds from this event is donated to Jerry's family by the festival founder and his co-host. I'm going to wrap things up here this week, but I will be back with a final series of stories from Punchbowl before wrapping up my time in Hawaii by talking about the most highly decorated unit in U.S. Army history, which has a deep connection to the islands and Punchbowl. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcast or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.